Josephine.
Oh, well, we started already? You hear that, Joe? Leo. Yeah. He started without me.
No, we're rolling.
We're rolling. Right. We'll start again, shall we? Sorry.
How does it feel? You have X number of weeks on the New York Times bestseller list?
Cain and Abel was 41 weeks on the Times bestsellers list, and Prodigal Daughter was over 6 months. You never get used to it, is the answer. Or at least I hope I never get used to it. Never lose the enthusiasm and the excitement that comes from the fact that the American people have been that good to me, because I am an Englishman, and I have written both the stories, Cain and Abel and The Prodigal Daughter, of course, is about the first woman president of the United States. And the Americans are a generous race, you know. They put me to number one on the New York Times bestsellers list on July the 4th, which was very kind of them.
Let's go back one further. Let me ask you a question about yourself. One year much younger than I expected, and I see according to the biographical data that you have had a career.
When I left Oxford, I'd always wanted to be a politician first and foremost, and sat for the Greater London Council, which is the same as your sort of New York City Council, and was elected to that at the age of 26, and intended always to go into the House of Commons, but found myself there rather surprisingly early, because I fought a three-cornered battle where the other two beat each other up, and I came up through the middle and became a Member of Parliament at the age of 29. In fact, was the youngest member of the House of Commons, which again was a very great privilege. I had 5 years in the House of Commons, perhaps the five happiest years of my life, because I really loved politics. Politics in Great Britain, as I'm sure you know, Donald, is very different to America. I mean, it's not based on big business or big finance. In fact, when I stood for Parliament, I was not allowed to spend more than $5,000 by law to get elected, one penny over the $5,000, and I would have been disqualified. I was a Conservative Member of Parliament. Indeed, when I was a Member of Parliament, Edward Heath was the Prime Minister. I then sat under the opposition Prime Minister Harold Wilson, and soon after I left, Margaret Thatcher became leader of the party. Well, I'd always wanted a full political life, and had long believed that it was necessary to be financially stable as a politician, and invested all the money I'd made in my small company, which specialised in films, television and the theatre, in a company called Aquablast, on the advice of the Bank of Boston. I invested my own money, and I was stupidly borrowed more from the bank, because I really believed it was bound to succeed, only to find it was run by a bunch of crooks, and they stole mine and everyone else's money. And overnight I was in debt for $1 million, and felt the only honourable thing to do was leave the House of Commons, because I worked out that on a parliamentary salary of $28,000 a year, it would have taken about 142 years to pay off the debt. And so left the House of Commons and wrote my first book, Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less. Much more to pass the time, for something to do, because I couldn't get a job, Donald. I couldn't actually get a job. Former members of Parliament who are in debt for $1 million are not the easiest people to employ. To my surprise, the book took off all over the world. And I suppose the Daily Telegraph in England summing up, well, you should have expected anyone who'd served in the House of Commons to be a good storyteller, was probably something to do with it. But basically, I was first and foremost a politician, and came to writing by mistake. I never intended to be a writer. I was facing bankruptcy, thank heavens. I never became bankrupt. In the United Kingdom, of course, bankruptcy is a very bad thing. It's a crime, almost, in the eyes of most people. In this country, of course, it's treated rather casually. I never wanted to go bankrupt, and it took the first two books, Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less, and Shall We Tell the President, to pay off all my debts, so I luckily never went bankrupt.
Well, I'm sure confused. Why did the third bankruptcy?
It's an interesting comment that only an American could make. An Englishman would find no query in that at all. I would have no career with the threat of bankruptcy over me. I would have no career with the chance that I could bank. My abilities were suspect, and certainly my judgment was. In this country, as I said earlier, Donald, that is, it's always received with shock and disbelief. But in England, if you go bankrupt, you're finished.
You set out to become a writer, but had you written before?
No, never. At Oxford, I spent, I'm afraid, more time on the track and field team than I did in the classroom. And I never saw myself as a writer. I came to writing by absolute mistake, by absolute inability to get any other job, which makes me wonder how many people out there have another talent they don't even know about. I often say to people, do you play the violin? And they say, don't be silly, of course I don't play the violin. And I say, really? Because when I was a Member of Parliament, if you'd said to me, you could write a book that would be number one on the New York Times bestsellers list, I'd have fallen about laughing. And I wonder how many people fall in the category of Proust's comment, that most of us end up doing the thing we're second best at? And how many people out there really could do something else, but actually never have the opportunity, or perhaps never take the opportunity?
What did you use to, as a pattern when you drafted your first
book? I think by nature I'm a storyteller, not a writer. And I can certainly say that I never know what's on the next line, I never know what's on the next page, and I never know what's in the next chapter. Even when I go to bed at night on the first draft of a book, and the first draft of Cain and Abel took 8 weeks, and then it took 16 drafts over 2 years to get it right. But on the first draft, I never know what's on the next page. And the answer to your question is that I just write for 2 hours, I correct the rest of the day and write for 2 hours the next day, correct the rest of the day, normally an 8-hour day, and I go to bed at night with no idea what I'm going to write the next day. And that, I think, is the storyteller. I think the writer probably plans out the plot and lines up what he wants to do and knows where he's going. But people often say to me, I never know how your books are going to end. To which I only have to reply, I don't know myself.
Do you find yourself dealing with a certain clumsiness in writing that you should say you spend the next portion of the day to correct them? Or does the words seem to flow naturally?
I think the storytelling flows naturally. I think the command of language doesn't. I was very worried about this until I read that Dickens had exactly the same problem, and I discussed it with Sir Vivian Pritchard, V.S. Pritchard, the great English short story writer, and I said, look, sir, I'm a very worried man, because on Cain and Abel I took 12 drafts before I even handed it in. He said, oh, don't worry, dear boy, don't worry. I took 14 drafts on my last book. And I realized that if you are going to make something good, unlike the painter, or perhaps more so unlike the sculptor, you do have a chance to go back and chisel again and get it right. Some people, I think, probably do hand in the first draft. They'd be far greater writers than I am. I chisel and chisel and chisel until I think it is the best I can do. Now, if I hand it over to you then, Donald, and you read it and you say, this is not very good, that is fine, because it's the best I can do. Nothing would be worse for me than to hand you over the third draft and you say, well, it's not very good, because I would know it wasn't very good. But when I've handed you the 12th draft, it really is the best I can do.
Dick Francis, who has been in this newsroom a number of times, has been prevailed upon by his American publisher to Americanize his books. Most of them take place in England. I think one of them takes place at least partially in the United States. It's the one that dealt with kidnapping of a horse in Kentucky. But most of his books do indeed take place in England, and he's been prevailed upon to change certain things in these books that might appeal to a more American public. Your books seem supremely American, of course. There are no British spellings that I noticed. What did you revamp the books for an American audience?
I think in the case of The Prodigal Daughter, the story of the first woman president of the United States, there was no purpose in writing the story of the first woman prime minister of Britain. It had been done in real life, and Margaret Thatcher has done a job which could not be fictionalized. The answer to your question is that I have two editors, one in Britain and one in the United States. My editor in the United States, indeed, takes the English version and, for using your word, Americanizes it, changes those words such as lifts into elevators, undergrounds into subways, and so on. I have always found America a fascinating subject to tackle, both in Cain and Abel and in The Prodigal Daughter, because I am genuinely fascinated by America and wish I'd been born here. Dick Francis writes about a world he knows very well indeed and covers competently, and I don't suspect he could do it in America because he doesn't know America. And I'm surprised his publishers bother to make him, because frankly, Agatha Christie proved with her books that you didn't have to ever set a book in America. When Watership Down was the most successful book of the decade, and it was rabbits set in an English countryside, and John le Carré is currently number one in the hardback, and I'm currently number one in the softback, and we're both Englishmen, and certainly in John le Carré's book there are no Americans. I think it's short-sighted of the American publisher not to allow an author to do what he wants to do. If he's a good enough storyteller, let him get on with it.
Well, Francis does want to get on with it. That's why he doesn't want to take a book that had been published the year before in Britain and try to revise it for another audience. The book's come out a year subsequent to the British book.
Yes, they seem to, yeah.
Are yours published?
Yes, absolutely, almost the same week, because I only do a book every 2 years, and sometimes 2.5 years. I'm not a very quick writer. I take a long time to do all the drafts. But The Prodigal Daughter has come out in paperback here today. It's the publication day. It comes out in Britain in 4 weeks' time. In the hardback, the British came out 2 weeks before the Americans, so it's always very close indeed. It suits me that way, because I do one tour of America and then one tour of Britain, and they come out together. I wouldn't like to see them a year apart.
Your American publisher then makes the manuscript in America?
In that sense, yes. Yes, because I think if you say he went up in the lift to his flat, you hesitate for a moment. But if you say he went up in the elevator to his apartment, you don't hesitate at all.
Yes, I wonder if that certainly would not be appropriate if you're writing about an American environment. Those terms. I would not think.
I take your point. What I try to do there is, if it is set totally in England, then I stay to the English text. If it is set in America, I try to stick to the American text and make the person, as the editor would say, stretch himself.
You seem to be, obviously, you are familiar with American politics. How did you go about doing the research and being able, in order to give yourself the background for an American setting?
Well, I suppose all my young life I've been fascinated by America. I was, as I said to you earlier, Donald, wish I'd been born here. I would love to have stood for the American Senate rather than the British House of Commons. I think American politics is far more exciting than British politics. Now, if I'd been born 100 years ago, I would love to have been a Member of Parliament in the days of Pitt, Palmerston, Disraeli, Peel, Gladstone, certainly. But today, the really most exciting country in the world is your country. So I've taken what I would call an amateur interest over many years. When it came to professionally researching, I spent considerable time in Washington using all my American contacts, and in the case of the prodigal daughter, actually chose a girl. I went to Elliot Richardson, who was then ambassador in Great Britain, and said, could you name three people you think might one day be president of the United States, three women? And I asked Anne Armstrong the same question, and I asked several people, and one name kept coming up, that of Janet Brown, who is currently a personal assistant to Vice President Bush. And I went to see her and said, you're the girl who keeps coming up. I want to research you rather than the books. I want to know all your life, from the day you were born right the way through. I want you to tell me why you want to be president, where you think you're going. Can a woman ever be president? And I listened to her for about a year before I wrote a word of The Prodigal Daughter, and then sat down and wrote her with her very much in mind. Of course, she's only 29, so by the time she'd reached and hasn't reached Congress, by the time she reached Congress, I had to turn to my other knowledge and background of America. No, funnily enough, many people think that's based on the daughter of the Hyatt chain, who was never in my mind, but subsequently, so often happens when you write a book, people tell you things afterwards, that the daughter of the head of the Hyatt chain is incredibly politically ambitious and competent. But no, I'd never met her, and no, that is not the case.
Well, to go a little further, just in terms of techniques for style, you can drop in songs, cigarettes.
No, they don't any longer, no. That was a reference to a time, a particular time.
So those things, how did you go about getting the flavor of the period as it progressed from the 30s to the
80s? I must admit I cheated on that. To start with, it was read by some very senior Americans to make sure that was authentic. But I would have to tell you that, in all honesty, a lot of it was stolen straight from The Power and the Glory by William Magister, which I think is one of the great books of all time. In the sense, it wasn't stolen word for word, but he would say on page 73, this was the year that Lucky Strike was the most successful. And I noted the year and thought, right, well, I need a cigarette there, so I'll use that one. I used his remarkable book as a background information, because I do think he's a very great writer. And I do actually think his History of America, The Power and the Glory, is one of the most remarkable books that's come out of America. And so for flavour, and for that side of the world, I read his book minutely twice, underlining, seconding, trying to feel, because I was only born in 1940 myself, so much of the stuff, the early Cain and Abel stuff, and indeed the early Prodigal Daughter stuff, I wouldn't have known because I wasn't even alive.
Did you find yourself with flaws, some errors, nuances that people gloss in writing an American sentence?
Well, I always have that double-checked. I have, as I said, an excellent American editor, and I have several American friends, two of them senators, one Congress, and three in publishing, who do a draft read with no intention other than to find silly mistakes. I think between them they found 17, and I corrected all 17. Subsequently, since the book has been out, two more have been pointed out, which is interesting. You can get past the senator, even on the Senate. And those two have been corrected for paperback. But little things even got past the senators. Well, you say you pass... this is a bad example because it's not accurate. He passed the Washington statue and climbed the seven stairs into the Senate chamber. 8 stairs, and it wasn't Washington, it was Lincoln. I mean, you can make that sort of mistake. And the senator reads it and says, yeah, of course it's Washington statue, I pass it every day. And then he's looked at it every day, hasn't actually noted that it's Lincoln, not Washington. And you can make tiny little mistakes. The voting takes place at 3:30 and the cards are placed in things behind the desks, and then you find it isn't behind the desks, actually it's on top of the desks, and it isn't 3:30, the bells go at 3:30, the vote's about 3:35. You can make such simple mistakes, and they can get past the senator because he also says it takes. But what happened with the several people who looked at it is, they, as I say, they picked up 17 mistakes, and I hope there are now none in the book at all.
17?
And it's 200,000 words.
Accurate. When you vote in Naples, did you have a publisher already established?
Yes, I'd already been. Well, there's a sad story behind that, which I can only tell honestly now you've answered the question. After Shall We Tell the President, Mrs. Jacqueline Onassis left the Viking Press because she said she didn't like the book, although she'd never read it, and she was very openly and honest about not reading it. She was then an editor at... No, she was a non-fiction editor, but she was in the house, and it was about Edward Kennedy. And I was very sad about that, of course. And a Viking had a contract with me to automatically buy my next book at $200,000 if they wanted it. And I presented Cain and Abel on the aforesaid day, and they had 14 days to decide. They read it and decided they didn't want to buy it. And so I put it up for auction, and it went for considerably more. And of course I therefore had to leave Viking. I didn't want to leave Viking, but they said they didn't want the book. So Cain and Abel went to another publisher.
It seems the publishers act like that, in spite of the amount of money that the book produced. Obviously, if you put this up for auction, I don't know how many bids you had, but obviously there was an interest in the book and the knowledge that it would probably sell very well.
Yes.
So obviously, there were these political factors involved with Viking's decision.
Absolutely. And I was very sad about that, because Viking, when I was there under Tom Ginsberg, I was very happy, and I was sorry to leave.
All of a sudden, you find yourself blessed with the great success, and people reading your books everywhere, and taking you to the beach. And, what does that feel like to see that you become almost a household term?
It's very thrilling, Donald, and it'd be very dishonest of anyone to say it isn't. I was in Fifth Avenue this morning, and the whole of the Barnes & Noble window is that picture on the front of The Prodigal Daughter. And there's, I suppose, 500 books, Prodigal Daughter books, in the window. And I stood outside, and the editor of Punch magazine in England came up and said, gee, it's bad enough getting away from you in England to then stand in Fifth Avenue and see you taking up. He said, I'm really, this is too much. I'm going home, he said. It's very thrilling. Very thrilling. So I went into Barnes & Noble and spoke to Kevin, who runs the paperback department there, because I take a great professional interest in who runs the departments and how they're done. And there were 20 people in the queue with the paperback books, and 8 of them had bought The Prodigal Daughter. And I have to tell you, Donald, it was very, very thrilling. Because I remember the days when I first came to America with my first book, Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less. And I stayed at the Metropolitan Club, and I walked down to Doubleday's on the corner, and they had 2 of my books only. And I walked down to Shribner's, and they had 1. And I walked down to Barnes & Noble, and they had 2. And when I returned a week later, they still had 2. The other stock still had 2, and the other one still had 1. And I stood by the corner, and I saw Michener's book in the corner, Centennial. And I saw 500 of them by the door. And I walked out and said, one day I'll walk into this shop, and there'll be 500 copies by the door. I walked into Barnes & Noble this morning, there were 1,200 copies by the door. And that was, I would be very dishonest of me not to say so, very thrilling. And I think if I lost that excitement and that enthusiasm ever, then I'd have to stop writing.
One last question. What's next for Jeffrey?
Well, I've decided that I'd like to write a story set in the House of Commons in England, and set in the House of Lords, and in novel form, show how the strange British system works, because I don't think the American people understand our rather weird system. Show them how the Commons and the Lords and how you become Prime Minister and how the Queen and the Royal Family function within such a body, but in novel form, so that they're once again only reading a story, but at the same time learning about how our customs work. And I hope now that, having written 4 books for America, this will be my 5th book, that it will not matter that it is totally English and has no American flavour in it. On the grounds that at the end of the day I'm nothing more than a simple storyteller, and I hope that the stories are enough to keep people entertained.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.